If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
In the spirit of ANU's motto, which is First to Know the Nature of Things, we acknowledge the traditional custodians of country throughout Australia and their connections to land, sea and waterways, which were never ceded. We pay our respects to their elders past and present and extend our respect to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples listening today.
I ask the Prime Minister,
how good is Australia?
Please explain. Here to make a public statement.
Look, I'm going to shirt front, Mr. Putin.
I am a fighter and not a quitter.
I don't think I know.
I want to thank that fellow down under.
Oh, fair shake of the sauce bottle, mate.
Welcome, Mark Kenny here with another Democracy Sausage for this week, which comes to you, of course, from the ANU. I'm with the Australian Studies Institute at ANU in the School of Politics and International Relations. Now, on April 1st, the Iranian consulate in Damascus, Syria, was attacked by a missile strike. There were 16 killed. While Israel does not formally acknowledge involvement, there is no doubt it was responsible. It's not denying so, and everyone is acting as if that is an accepted fact. 3 nights ago, Iran hit back, launching waves of attack drones as well as ballistic and cruise missiles at Israel. It was the first time Iran has directly attacked Israel, certainly in this period. So what happens now? To discuss this very worrying escalation and the international response amid the tragedy of war in Gaza, it's welcome back to former Foreign Minister and, of course, former longtime Premier of New South Wales, Bob Carr. Hi there, Bob.
G'day, Mark.
Bob, as we record this on Tuesday morning, I just wonder if I could get your response to what has now been declared a terrorism investigation of a stabbing in Western Sydney last evening. And it came, of course, so quickly after the Bondi Junction attack, which left so many dead, I think 7 in all, including the attacker, and saw as that unfolded, as that horrendous event unfolded on Saturday afternoon in Sydney, saw social media alight with false claims of terrorist motive and so forth. Now, that turned out to be, of course, wrong, but this attack that's occurred on a bishop in an Assyrian church is now being investigated as a terrorist incident, and we'll see where that goes. But I suppose I'm just interested, before we go to the other matters, interested in getting your response as a former long-time Premier of New South Wales and therefore a government leader as well as the other responsibilities you've had, just to sort of reflect on the need for accurate information in these situations and also to just for the sort of deft leadership we need to ensure maximum social cohesion when these events are occurring.
Yeah, I think the key message to media, to the public and to people in government responsibility is not to rush to judgment. You've got to get the evidence. You've got to have hard, solid facts before you start saying things. And the lesson of all the media inaccuracy out of the Bondi incident is to confirm that. And I hope that out of this incident overnight in a church gathering in Sydney, everyone's more careful. The tone from government has got to be, as indeed it has been, let's get all the facts in. Let's get all the facts before us before we start saying things and making assumptions.
Yeah, that's right. And I think it's important to say that a lot of media on Saturday in respect of the Bondi Junction attack of this person who seems to have had some psychosis or some mental illness issues, as we understand it at the moment. But I think most media, you know, formal media, were quite responsible and did hold yes. judgment. Social media was, of course, the sewer that it has become, particularly ex-Twitter, with people making ridiculous suggestions. But there were a number of sort of what you might say community leaders, not just in Australia, but in Britain and other places, who were saying outrageous things about this and putting it into the context, I suppose, of the tensions we're about to talk about in the Middle East, with absolutely no evidence of that at all. I mean, and there were one or two media organisations that did succumb to the temptation to sort of be first in making these kinds of connections as well. So there's a leadership role to be played by media in these circumstances, but it's pretty hard to tame the torrent of invective and you know, lies, basically, or mistruths, misinformation, disinformation that flows on social media.
Yeah, a lot of the Arab background or Islamic community is feeling a bit battered anyway because of the response in Australia to what's happening in Gaza. And they need to be reassured, with government saying, we're listening to you. They'd be very hurt by that social media assumption that a stabbing incident, an attack on shoppers, had to be linked to a Muslim. They'd be very hurt by that. That feeds their sense of injustice, and their sensitivities are as marked as those of people in the Jewish community who feel a bit battered by the criticism being made of Israel. So the role of government is to say, let's take a step back. Let's not make assumptions. Let's not rush to judgment. Please remember throughout this that no country has made multiculturalism, immigration from different national sources, work as well as this country, Australia. It is perhaps the biggest source of pride in the Australian achievement.
Yeah, very well said, very well put. And I suppose it's in the context of that that we turn to this next subject, which is the main subject that we're talking about today, which is the Middle East. We do have a situation now, as Peter Hartcher pointed out in a piece he wrote, where the Islamic Republic of Iran has attacked, in response, the Jewish state. I mean, we have a very strong kind of religious overlay here. We have these communities in this country inflamed by this situation as well, and we have a lot of domestic heat in this. Let's go to the facts as we know them, though, in terms of the strikes. We had that strike, as I say, on April 1 of the consulate building attached to the embassy in Damascus, the Iranian embassy. 16 dead. The target was Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps Brigadier General Mohammad Reza Zahedi. There were seven other of his military colleagues who were killed as well in that attack. And then we've had the response, which happened, as I say, in the last 2.5-3 days. Interestingly, that response was massive and yet foreshadowed. That is to say that, as I understand it, the Iranians did signal to the US what it was going to do and when it was going to do it. That's interesting in itself, isn't it? It suggests that there has been, in a sense, a large and yet symbolic, in some ways, attempt to respond.
Yes, with America perhaps partly in response to that, the candid sharing of objectives with Iran by Iran, America in response to that now arguing a case for Israeli restraint.
Yeah.
The question that stands out for me is Netanyahu's motivation, and we can make assumptions about his motivation given the character.
His initial motivation, you mean, in terms of the April 1 attack, yes.
Yes, that's right. And put yourself in Netanyahu's position, a wily political survivor, the longest-serving prime minister of Israel, but someone who's in a very vulnerable position in terms of the cabinet and Knesset balance of forces, and someone for whom the stakes are high. He faces possible legal action, the removal from the prime minister's job if his coalition falls apart. He's got pressures from the left and from the right, and a ferment of public opinion at his front door. He approves this strike, and all of a sudden the conversation changes. The focus is not on the slaughter of aid workers or on the bigger slaughter of civilian Palestinians in Gaza. It's not speculation any longer about his move on Rafah, and he's told people that he's determined to move into Rafah. It's not about his own failure, now a big issue with Israeli public opinion, to rescue the remaining hostages or to defeat, to capture, to eliminate all of the Hamas leadership. So the war is in trouble, extraordinarily difficult war, one must say. He is defensive about it. This changes the landscape. And all of a sudden, he's pitched as a national champion against Iranian aggression in a conflict where Sunni Arab states are showing support for Israel against their archenemy.
Yes, it's a really extraordinary picture. And of course, it's not the first attacks that Israel has launched against Iran proxies or suspected proxies and others since this Gaza campaign has been underway. We've, of course, seen a rocket attack in suburban Beirut, as I understand it, and there have been, you know, constant skirmishes happening across Israel's northern border into southern Lebanon with Hezbollah, which are regarded, of course, as very much an Iranian proxy. And this is one of the Israeli frustrations, that it is, in effect, fighting proxies of Iran through the Houthis from Yemen and from what's happening in Lebanon and elsewhere. And so Bibi has taken the fight directly to the Iranians with the attack on April 1, and we've seen this response now.
I think we're now going to ask ourselves the question, from the spectrum of possible responses to the drone and missile attacks on Israel from Iran, which one is Netanyahu drawn to? And the spectrum includes assaulting Iranian proxies, such as Hezbollah, but that means Israel bogged down in Gaza, launching a fight on its northern border, and Hezbollah are proven fighters who have defeated the IDF in the past, a remarkable achievement, a non-state actor with a militia that defeated the professionals, conscript army, admittedly, of Israel.
What year was that? Was that 2008, was it?
Yes.
Yeah.
And a very significant defeat for the IDF and Prime Minister Sharon, but a measure of the resilience of Hezbollah. You've got the possibility that Israel could respond by targeted assassinations and by a cyber attack on Iranian institutions, and might opt to take their time about it. They could, of course, and this is at the extreme end of the spectrum of available responses, open the bottom drawer and take out their plans, their long-standing plans to attack Iranian nuclear facilities. But we know that they are dug deep and hard for even American-style bunker buster bombs to demolish. And that would probably tip the balance and ensure that Iran, in response, goes full out to weaponize its nuclear capacity. There are a range of things that Israel could do, but Netanyahu would be smiling that he's changed the conversation, the attention's off Gaza, off what he does in the next phase of this war, and he's got an American president on the phone urging him, begging him not to create a war in the Middle East. And that Netanyahu would be being advised, here we come back to the fascination of the secret world of Middle East, Israel-Palestine discourse, Netanyahu would be being advised by his American experts that Biden does not want a Middle East war, not least because of the domestic consequences in the US.
Absolutely. In a way, he's got three constituencies that he is juggling at the moment, Bibi. He's got the Americans, as you just mentioned, that he's in a dialogue with and heavily reliant on and feeling the pressure from. He's got voters who he'd love to keep at bay, and he can keep them at bay as long as this war continues. But once the war is over, there's huge difficulties for him coming, as you say, not just in respect of criminal proceedings, but also in respect of his extremely low support, recriminations over the massive intelligence failure of October 7. And then within his government, he's got the Maddies. He's got, you know, Bezalel, Smotrich, and Itamar Ben-Gvir. And Ben-Gvir himself, defense security minister, I think he is, has openly threatened Netanyahu that if he in any way walks back his plans or equivocates on his plans for a ground invasion in Rafah, then the coalition will disintegrate, that Bibi will no longer have the support. So it's a sort of a Rubik's Cube of violence and unattractive options.
Yeah, and then you've got the whole secret world of Middle Eastern diplomacy. A secret world, as one Palestinian diplomat once said to me, that explains almost everything. For example, in decades past, Israel seemed to undermine the Palestine Liberation Organization, Fatah, shifting money to Hamas, then not seen as a real threat, but enabling them to build mosques and to run charities. You've got Hezbollah, which didn't exist before the Israeli invasion of South Lebanon. It came to life as a resistance organization to an Israeli occupation of traditionally Shia regions of Lebanon. you've got Hamas operating as a diplomatic presence in European capitals. And we can imagine that on some level there are exchanges between Israelis and Hamas diplomats, and indeed the CIA and other American security agencies and diplomats talking to everyone on the other side, Hezbollah, Hamas included. I'm not saying this is deplorable. I'm not saying it's wrong to keep these exchanges secret. Jaw, better than war,
yeah,
anytime.
Yeah.
But there is a whole secret history here, and sometimes it comes to the surface and demands explanation. Like, for example, the reasons that Netanyahu launched that attack on the Iranian facility in Damascus, and like the whole Israeli campaign over many years to take out nuclear scientists in Tehran, enough for any number of TV series. Yeah. From a Western point of view, not at all deplorable. Better to do that, this secret warfare, than to plunge the world into the horrors of a full-scale Israeli assault on the Iranian facilities, especially while there's some evidence that Iran has pulled back from what it might otherwise do with weaponization of its nuclear capacity.
Let's be frank about this too. There is a theory, and it's a pretty widely shared theory, including within Israel, including within the progressive media, that the attack on April 1 of that Damascus embassy consular building was part of a desire that Netanyahu has to draw the US into a war. If war ends up being the outcome between Israel and Iran, that draws the US in. Biden has, even in the context of these extraordinarily fractious times, this moment, has again reiterated that America stands fully and completely with Israel. Is Netanyahu, as some people have theorized, of the view that he needs to sort out this Iranian problem once and for all, and the only way that can be dealt with is by a proper war that involves the US?
Yeah, the conventional wisdom in that circle of Israeli opinion is that Iran is the existential threat.
Yeah.
That they've achieved diplomatic relations with the Sunni states, and Iran is the constantly destabilizing presence. Their pressure on the Trump administration to tear up a comprehensive treaty signed onto by all the world's major powers that stopped Iran going nuclear, of course, was a tragic mistake. Even UN security agencies publicly, in evidence to the Congress, said Iran was adhering to the restraints of that treaty. Trump tore it up in the spirit of Netanyahu's request to the US Congress when he outrageously interfered in US domestic politics by accepting an invitation from Republicans to address the Congress under the Obama presidency. So,
without visiting the president, I seem to recall.
Yeah, it was a shocking intrusion, and it was I think the beginning of the poisoning of relations between large parts of the Democratic Party and Israel that has become very prominent since the Gaza War.
What do you make of Jordan's involvement in the recent repelling of this attack that occurred a couple of nights ago from Iran? Because we understand that Iron Dome, Israel's legendary missile defense system, worked extraordinarily well. Something like 99% is the figure being quoted of the missiles and drones and so forth were neutralized with no damage done to Israel. There are a few that landed, but supposedly without any significant damage or loss of Israeli life. Cooperating with Israel with that Iron Dome defense system was the UK, the US, and we're told Jordan. Quite a significant thing, is it not, that an Arab nation, an Arab state, is also involved in the defense of Israel there?
Yes, and a striking confirmation that Israel has made substantial progress in its relations with Arab states, largely because they see Iran under the leadership of the Revolutionary Guard as a destabilizing, very militant threat to them and regional peace. I remember being in Amman as foreign minister. We're having dinner with some Jordanian diplomats at an outdoor restaurant. It was a balmy night. There's a massive roar overhead. It shook the tables, made it impossible to talk. I said to our Jordanian hosts, what on earth was that aircraft? They said, for a day, we've had a visit from the CIA director, and that was his plane bearing his communication. And that little incident drove home to me the comfort, from Washington's point of view, of their diplomatic position across the Middle East. Jordan is effectively an American ally, certainly a deep-dyed partner. America's got more clout in the region than any of its challengers, more soft power, more diplomatic friendships. And on the bottom line, Jordan will be counted a friend of America's, and on the bottom line, just possibly of Israel's.
And just before we go to a break, is that under strain as a result of the extreme nature of Israel's behavior and U.S. support for it? Or U.S.
Oh, yes, it is. No, it is, because you could see with Saudi Arabia a pullback from the promise of the Abraham Accords in response to the sheer savagery and the criminality of much of the behavior of Israel in Gaza. So the brilliance of Netanyahu's elevation of conflict with Iran, if we accept those assumptions being made about the attack on Damascus, is that he shifted the whole definition of conflict in the Middle East. If the Iranians were to show restraint, and the Israelis too, to moderate their response, then attention will not be diverted from Rafah and everything else happening in Gaza. If it gets back to Gaza and the plight of Palestinians being starved to death and shifted from their homes being systematically destroyed, 80% of their housing is apparently destroyed, then it is so much harder for Arab states to be seen to be helping Israel.
Just quickly before we go to that break, one final question. You've had a long interest in US politics as well. How difficult is this moment for Biden domestically in terms of the looming election?
Yeah, two concerns. One would be the effect of a war in the Middle East on fuel prices, because he's on the defensive about inflation, and the American electorate is extraordinarily sensitive to the spiking prices when they buy their petrol. And second, he'd be concerned about inflaming the sense of Arab-American grievance, that he, as an old cold warrior, is still imbued with an exodus narrative about the origins and nature of Israel and neglecting them. In the conflict of continuing tensions in the Middle East, the prospect of Democratic voters with Arab backgrounds staying at home or voting for a third-party candidate and hence throwing away their vote in Wisconsin and Michigan is very strong.
Yes, it's such a complex picture with so many different agendas and imperatives and history and the like. We'll talk after the break about Australia's role and that of some other countries. Back in a moment.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
When the wind veered, the smoke was driven backwards, revealing a most amazing scene. Standing columns of fire.
To Be Continued is a new podcast that explores the rich world of lost literary fiction from Australia's past.
It helps you to understand the way in which knowledge is kind of not something that's out there waiting to be discovered, but it's something that you create.
To Be Continued is brought to you by the Australian National University and is available now on your favourite podcast app.
Welcome back. I'm talking with Bob Carr. We were talking just before the break about America's domestic situation. Domestically here, Penny Wong, the foreign minister last week, Bob, cautiously floated the idea of elevating Palestinian state recognition, of holding that out as a possibility, as a way of unlocking, I guess, the devilish puzzle of this Middle Eastern conflict that's been going on for so long. She put some fairly strong conditions on that, not least being the immediate release of the hostages, the recognition of Israel as secure within its borders, the complete removal of Hamas as a force within any Palestinian state. Nonetheless, it touched off a pretty vociferous reaction from the opposition, which said it was the worst betrayal of an ally that it had seen and so forth. Most irresponsible statement by a foreign minister, I think Peter Dutton said. What was your sense of it?
The response to this very cautious diplomatic language and positioning was ridiculous, utterly ridiculous. I read articles that were so inflammatory, you couldn't have said they had any link to what Penny Wong actually said. And they conveniently overlooked that Lord Cameron, former Conservative Prime Minister of the United Kingdom, had opened the door to Palestinian recognition before the conclusion of the peace process.
Indeed, and he's now the foreign minister, right?
He's now foreign secretary speaking for the British government. Moreover, in Washington, in the White House, there were spokespeople who said, yes, indeed, recognition need not occur at the end of the process. Separate to that, you've got a cluster of EU members. They seem to include Spain and Norway, certainly Ireland, Belgium, Slovenia, Portugal, saying we're moving to recognise Palestinian statehood. That is, they're not bound by a common EU position, which they're not. Thirdly, you've got Algeria likely to move a motion in the Security Council elevating Palestinian membership in the UN to full state membership, not observer status. So there are three developments. And by the way, on the last, America's almost certain to veto that. Domestic legislation probably requires it. But that would ping-pong the issue back in to the General Assembly. The General Assembly can't admit a new UN member, which is what elevating Palestinian status to full state membership mean. But it means Australia will have to take a stand. So here are questions for Australia. How do we vote in the General Assembly if the question comes up? If we abstain, vote no, that will be interpreted in Australia, certainly by Arab background voters, as three steps backwards after the tentative step forward that Foreign Minister Wong has just very properly executed in her ANU speech. Second, if a group of EU members, Ireland and Spain and Norway and the others, recognise Palestinian statehood, why would we hold back, given it's in the national platform of the ALP and Penny Wong has, a little bit cautiously, opened the question? And three, if David Cameron and people in the Washington administration are implicitly saying we've had it up to here with Netanyahu, we think one legitimate response is to bring forward recognition of a Palestinian entity to save the two-state solution, why on earth would we hold back as a middle power? And there'd be a sense in Washington that if we were to do that along with the Europeans, that strengthens Biden's hand in saying to Bibi, listen, the extremism of your behaviour, the disproportionality of what you're doing in Gaza, the scale of civilian casualties has lost you the support of these Western nations. Exercise restraint.
It's true, isn't it? I mean, that is the trajectory of world opinion as a result of the excess in Gaza, the excessive loss of civilian life, the indifference to that in pursuit of Hamas terrorists, as is Israel's justification. You can chart it. You can see that Israel's reputation, its standing, has been materially harmed by this. Now, there are those people who still will stick with it no matter what. The opposition's made it pretty clear that there is no red line there that Israel could cross that would see the opposition's support for the administration in Israel weaken. But the rest of the world, I think, is looking at this afresh. The other thing that strikes me as common sense about this is that we're really talking about a process here, and we're talking about hope. And the hope of Palestinian statehood, I mean, because it's been a dwindling hope, being materially stripped away with endless settlements in the West Bank, occupied West Bank and other places, it strikes me that changing that dynamic of giving the Palestinian people the realistic prospect of statehood is a path to responsible behaviour on both sides.
Yeah, you must give hope to those Palestinians who oppose Hamas and are seeking a peaceful road to nationhood in line with the essence and the promise of the Oslo Accords from the early 1990s.
And which looks realistic, which actually looks attainable.
Yes, yeah, two states for two peoples with security guarantees for Israel. And the Palestinians even saying, well, put it on the agenda, but we will consider being a demilitarized state, which is the ultimate security guarantee for Israel, because Netanyahu tells every international visitor, I was one, I know of other former foreign ministers who in his office have been treated to a little pantomime, and he's entitled to press his case, when Netanyahu gets up from his desk, stands by the window, points to the hills of Jerusalem and says, I don't want to see Hamas, or you might have said Hezbollah, on those hills. Well, the ultimate guarantee that they can't manifest themselves within a Palestinian state on the side of the occupied West Bank is that that Palestinian state has got a police force but not an army. And that means effectively that Israel can go in and take out Hamas or Hezbollah. Now, no negotiator would put it in that brutal language, but when Palestinian negotiators say, we will talk about the prospect of being a demilitarized state, that's the security guarantee that they're implicitly offering their Israeli interlocutors.
How hard will it be, though? I mean, as I say, a very strong reaction against Wong's suggestion and probably against these moves in other EU member states, for example. But how difficult will it be to meet those thresholds anyway of creating viable institutions that are essential for the establishment of a state?
I think with European and American assistance, a Palestinian state can flourish. Israel is pragmatic enough to mobilize investment and see that it has a viable economic relationship that sustains a Palestinian state, and with time becomes as well disposed to Israel because it's got a stake in the common prosperity of the region as Jordan is, which we previously spoke about. I mean, that's the promise of Palestinian statehood with a leadership, a non-Islamist leadership, reinforced by support from the West. It's a small parcel of land. And in the context of a regional peace deal, it's not excessively idealistic to see it rendered prosperous with support of the Gulf states, the Europeans, and the United States.
What about Gaza? The prospect of a Palestinian state, two states side by side, is difficult to imagine in respect of Gaza and the occupied West Bank because they are not contiguous, they are not joined. How does that get resolved? And indeed, who is responsible for the rebuilding of Gaza, assuming that it remains as Palestinian territory? Because it's been pulverized.
Yeah, that is a very difficult question. I think we've got to carve that out of the issue of a Palestinian state on the occupied West Bank. We've got to carve that out and look at an arrangement that can satisfy the security needs of Israel while enlisting the support, a very hard task indeed, of a hugely suffering Gazan population. Now, what governance arrangements can apply in Gaza is something entirely up in the air at this point and really deserves the attention of the best diplomatic minds in the world. But the realism, we can assume, still resides in Israel, would predispose them to wanting PA, a Palestinian Authority, ruling Gaza. The Gazan population is probably more committed to Hamas now than they were before Israel's disproportionate response to the horrors of the Hamas attack on October 7. And this is a problem, a diplomatic problem, a governance problem from hell.
Yes, I read somewhere recently that a number of the Hamas fighters that are now in bitter conflict with Israel are the sons, the orphaned sons of fighters from the last time Gaza and Israel were at war. Yeah, perfect evidence, if that's true, of the radicalization cycle that really exists as a result of this kind of unrestrained violence.
Yeah. My instincts would be to see that we get Palestinian state on the occupied West Bank, that Israel is allowed to extract the best security guarantees, and that means demilitarization of that Palestinian state, and that you can then look at the massive task of rebuilding Gaza and weep at the expense required to rebuild 80% of the population's housing that had been so profligately destroyed by Israeli force in the last 5 months.
Now, you mentioned before about a number of EU states that are wrestling with this issue and moving towards possible recognition of Palestinian statehood. I wonder what capacity there is for Europe as a whole, or the European Union, to move in this regard or to play a leadership role. And in the context of the difficulties in Ukraine, whether Europe has the bandwidth for, you know, for showing leadership and playing that constructive role. Because it's not just going to be the US, is it?
No, I think it depends on Macron. Germany, because of its historic record, its responsibility for the Holocaust, will never retreat from a supportive position towards Israel.
That's true. But interestingly, I have been speaking to some people, you know, pretty well-connected people, who say that there is a change in the debate, even in Germany, as a result of Israeli excess, and also in this desire to do something to change this dynamic, you know, this endless cycle of death.
It'd be interesting to watch. In the meantime, they, as I understand it, they supply military aid to Netanyahu. Hence, the first confirmation of a European movement will come from France.
Mm-hmm.
And it'd be nice to have a listening device in the presidential office and hear his dialogue with EU partners who've said they're moving to recognise Palestine.
Yeah. And do you think that we'll see any material movement from Australia in between now and our election?
Well, it's going to be hard for Labor to ignore it because of the seething frustration and the sense of vulnerability among Arab background citizens. And if Labor's always seen to retreat from backing a Palestinian state, despite having a clear platform commitment to do it, and despite the promise of Penny Wong's recent speech, then there'll be a price to be paid at polling booths. And Arab background voters are absolutely entitled to say, we're horrified by what's been happening in Gaza, and it seems a federal government, the federal Labor government, is too over-responsive to Israeli sensitivities and not listening enough to us. So I think if EU members move, if there's a vote in the UN, if Biden's frustration with Netanyahu becomes more manifest and we somehow continue to hold back from what's required, then there'll be a price to be paid at the polls and voters are entitled to make a decision about it.
And it might even suggest that the sort of ferocious reaction from the opposition has had a material effect on our foreign policy, bearing in mind that two states is actually bipartisan policy as well. I mean, this gets lost in a lot of this division between the two sides.
Yeah, the two-state solution is the only solution. Israel is not going to agree to a single state, that is, with the Arab population on the West Bank voting in national elections. Forget that. It's a fantasy. And it's Palestinians who live in the diaspora, not Palestinians on the West Bank, who are saying, oh, no, everything must be in abeyance till we get a single state. We're not going to accommodate this nonsense of a two-state solution. Two-state solution is the only solution, unless you accept that Israel will permanently occupy a majority Arab population on the West Bank. And two-state solution requires an end to settlement expansion because the settlement expansion that's been accelerated since October is all about smothering the prospect of the Palestinian state in line with what is now explicit Netanyahu cabinet policy, no two states. Hence the importance of this tool of diplomatic recognition in response to the adamantine Israeli opposition to a Palestinian state. What is the West to do? What is the West to do? And for some Western countries, UK, US and us, the total alienation of our Arab-speaking citizens because we keep refusing to take that final step is a big problem of political management. It is the alienation of Arab background voters who are saying we've got a right to be heard. The other side keeps being heard. Governments are terribly responsive, putting the Israeli flag up on the Opera House, for example. Admittedly, in a very early stage of this war, but Arab background voters feel pretty isolated and very much taken for granted.
Final question. Put yourself in the shoes of Hamas in Gaza. Wouldn't a smart thing for them to do now be to release the hostages? I mean, this is an intolerable situation, and right now, for better or worse, they have achieved, because of Israel's success, I think something they may not have even imagined possible when they started all of this, which is that there is international pressure on Israel because of Israel's success, as we've been talking. If they released the hostages now, that would put Israel in a difficult position. I mean, not Israel, but Netanyahu and Ben-Gvir and those who are saying that a ground invasion of Rafah has to occur. Release the hostages, what happens then? I mean, wouldn't you do that if you were Hamas?
Yes, except I can't see Hamas as a rational actor.
No.
What they did, I saw instantly. I tweeted to this effect. I sent a note to Palestinian friends to this effect in the first week of the war. I said they've done enormous damage to the cause of Palestinian state.
Yeah.
Their murderous criminality directed at Israeli civilians. And I'm interested in everything about this organization and its shadowy existence. Interested that it's got a political, administrative, and diplomatic arm, as well as that militia and terrorist arm. But an absence of publicly available intelligence about this organization and the forces within it, I think, is a disability from which we all suffer.
Yes, and it would be a very backward step to see that organization continuing its control of Palestine's future, the future of Palestinians.
Yeah, I share the criticism made of Hamas by American sources in particular, that it was gifted with a huge amount of money, I understand, flowing in from Qatar. It did not opt to spend that money on schools, colleges, first world healthcare for its people, but to spend it on tunnels and rockets. Hamas has been a malign presence in this conflict, and Palestinians have suffered. Therefore, it's very depressing to contemplate what we all assume is real evidence that support for Hamas among the suffering people has gone up.
Mm.
Again, we're talking about the convoluted and dire politics, the forces at work in this region, Mark. One diplomatic position to retreat to constantly. Two states for two people with the required security guarantees that means Jews and Arabs, Israelis and Palestinians can live in peace side by side.
Well, let's just hope that this is inching closer to reality as a result of the sharp deterioration in the circumstances for all of the people in the region and that we are seeing moves now that might, as I say, unlock something that has been completely horrendous and devastating for a long period of time now. And I guess we wait with bated breath to see whether Netanyahu is going to succumb to his instinct for excess here and for force and attack Iran again in some way, however that manifests. We know the US is urging caution, saying, look, take it as a win. They didn't get their missiles through. Leave it at that. But yes, so much is in flux at the moment and none of it is good. And we'll just have to monitor this closely. Bob, thanks so much for coming on Democracy Sausage again.
Pleasure, Mark. Thank you.
And that is the podcast for this week. We'll look forward to talking to you again next week. Until then, bye for now.